We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right, a couple more weeks without Maria, and then hopefully she will be returning.
Yes. So, the return of Maria.
Yeah.
The sequel.
Starting out with local and an outstanding article by Ashley Hiroko at KUOW with the title, Seattle Rape Cases Move to Back Burner, Police Insiders Say.
Yeah, and I would highly recommend people seek it out. As investigative reporting goes, it's top-notch. And to say that's a little bit of a surprise coming from KUOW, but it is. So the upshot of the article is that for some reason, SPD has deprioritized investigating cases of sexual assault. They had a 16% arrest rate in 2019, excuse me, 14% in 2019. It's 1.6%, in this year so far. So, it's really been, completely deprioritized, and, there's almost no arrest going on for sexual assault cases. Now, some of those, there are investigations still going on, for sure, but that doesn't explain that kind of discrepancy, and it doesn't explain why SPD has really fallen down on the job on that. I would note parenthetically that over the years, I've gotten a lot of stories from women of SPD ignoring restraining orders, taking the side of the guy in domestic violence cases, that kind of thing. And, it seems to be a department-wide, institutional misogyny. And I don't know if that has anything to do with this or not, but it was a truly alarming story and should have gotten a lot more attention than I think it did.
Yeah. If it's okay with you, I wouldn't mind sharing some of the actual text from the article, because it's just damn good reporting.
Mm-hmm.
So the reporter at KOW got to talk with several people, at least two people that work at SPD, who shall remain nameless. Obviously, they could face some serious flack for sharing some of the information that they have, but this is a quote from one of them. The Seattle Police Department Sexual Assault Unit is not at all investigating adult sexual assault reports or cases unless there was an arrest, said one source inside the Seattle Police Department. And it appears that a lot of the lead on this has to be given to Mayor Bruce Harrell with his new emphasis on visible crime, you know.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Oh, I'm sorry. That wasn't a quote. That was me paraphrasing.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I read the article, but I forgot to mention that little detail. Yeah.
From the article, a new mayor means a new policing strategy, and Mayor Bruce Harrell made it clear during his campaign that he aims to address visible crime, quote, end quote. Since Harrell assumed office, at least 7 patrol officers have been moved over to help empty tent encampments. Seattle officers are targeting city crime hotspots. That continues to get major coverage by corporate media. People purchasing and selling drugs and stolen goods from big box stores. The staffing challenges within the specialty team of the Seattle Police Department are driven by the lack of active police staffing, Jamie Housen, spokesperson for Mayor Harrell, said by email. Seattle detectives continue to investigate crimes reported in early 2020, the employee said. Early 2020 is
when, so over a year ago.
Yeah.
No, over 2 years ago.
Two years ago. That's yeah. Where they currently are, you know, in the hopper. And there was mention in the article about how people who file a sexual assault case generally don't get responded to. A quote from the article, fewer officers means that in some cases, people calling to report a sexual assault are routed to the automated telephone reporting unit designed to address non-urgent calls such as stolen checks. Again, from the article, it's always been difficult for survivors who choose to report their assault to police or pursue criminal charges, said Mary Ellen Stone, chief executive officer of King County Sexual Assault Resource Center. Stone pointed to a report her group published last year, which found that among a backlog of cases in King County Superior Court, there was 408 sexual assault victims who had been waiting on average 563 days for disposition.
That's almost 2 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Quote, we want to look
and that's just once it gets to the court system.
Exactly. Quote, we want to look at this not as, oh my goodness, this all of a sudden happened, end quote, Stone said, but quote, this has been the state for some time and now it's worse. And another significant issue is, quote from the article, there were 958 deployable officers at the end of December. In 2019, there were 1,281. Doss said a big part of the staffing problem is attributed to officers out on extended leave. This issue began in 2020, he said, by email. Many of the officers on extended leave now are using their accrued time, likely before departing permanently. Some of those were employees who refused to get vaccinated by October 18th, Doss said.
Right.
So we're constantly hearing in the media about how Seattle's police department is grossly understaffed, but it doesn't seem like there's been much focus on the amount of people who are on leave, according to the stats within this article.
Yeah, because they're still getting paid.
Exactly. And in the article, as of end of 2021, 958 deployable officers and 181 on leave. That's 19% that are on leave collecting pay with the bulk of those apparently planning on permanently leaving. So, again, it's an issue that doesn't seem to get much airplay with corporate media and probably deserves a lot more focus, both by media and the oversight body, city council. So,
and you know, this kind of bleeds into the, I was going to mention this with the next item, that, you know, it has been almost 2 years now since Carmen's Best left, and we have not had a permanent SPD police chief in that time. So, you know, when's that going to happen? You know, we have heard nothing from the Harrell administration so far about, you know, even putting a call out for applications.
Well, he actually made an announcement this week that he's officially looking for a new police chief.
Okay. I did not see that.
That was on Thursday.
Well, I suppose that's progress. The next item I was going to mention is that King County, whose sheriff's position opened about the same time, announced 3 finalists this week. So they're moving apace, and SPD has not been. So, and much of that, of course, is on former Mayor Durkin, who didn't want to look for a police chief while she served out the rest of her lame duck term.
Another item of context for this current issue with Seattle rapes and assaults is to remind people that it was the Washington State Legislature had to recently step in and provide additional funding and leadership to get the Washington State Patrol Crime Lab to finally begin testing their backlog of rape kits that they'd been sitting on for years and that numbered in thousands.
In some cases, decades. I mean, it was absurd. Yeah.
So it really points to not only Seattle police and Seattle having a serious issue with this, but it appears to be pretty much statewide. This issue just is not a priority.
And we certainly don't know about that status within, you know, smaller local departments, for instance, suburban police forces. But I would hazard a guess that if anybody went digging, and I don't know who that person would be since there's so little local reporting these days, you know, you'd find a similar kind of backlog and a similar kind of antipathy towards survivors.
And again, another item out of this KOW coverage was pointing out that people who are sexually assaulted, who take the time to report through the current, you know, channels that be, then turn around and get super frustrated and turn around and then report to other people that they know about their frustrations. And then those sexual assaults and rapes are never even reported at all, because who the hell wants to go through that?
Yeah. And that's a struggle for a survivor to report that in the first place. So yeah, it's a bad situation.
And meanwhile, all these people that committed these sexual assaults are still walking free and continuing to do this. It's just nuts.
Yeah, you know? It is. It is. Yeah. Okay. Moving on to happier news. Yeah. Oh, I should say the King County finalists for sheriff. There's three finalists. And remember, this vacancy occurred when the previous sheriff resigned after voters voted in November of 2020 to make the King County Sheriff's position appointed again rather than elected. And it's probably made clear that she was not going to get appointed to continue as sheriff. There's three finalists. One of them is the current interim sheriff, who is a woman named Patty Cole Tindall. Charles Kimball, who's the chief of police in Killeen, Texas, which is outside Fort Hood. It's a city of about 100,000. And Reginald Mormon, who is a major in, not the chief, but a major in the Atlanta Police Department. Now, this strikes me as a pretty weak field for a King County Sheriff's position that oversees not only Metro Transit policing, but also transit policing, rather, for, you know, a county of 2 million people. There you have it. Those are the three finalists, and they must be tremendously impressive people. That's all I can say. And King County Executive Dow Constantine is in charge of that process.
Okay. So, do you know if there's any going to be any public forums, anything on that people can
Constantine's office did not make any kind of announcement about that. So, I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll see if we can find out more about that for...
Yeah, I'll follow up on that for next week.
All right. Okay. Moving on, Erica C. Barnett this week talking about Sound Transit renewing its fare enforcement.
Yeah. Sound Transit, which is, you know, the Sounder trains and the light rail trains and some regional buses, stopped its fare enforcement on a light rail when the pandemic started in March of 2020. And afterwards, they've reinstated fares, I believe, at the beginning of last year, but they haven't had the uniformed officers going around enforcing them. And one of the reasons that that was cited for stopping the fare enforcement officers was the racial disparity in enforcement, that people of color riding the light rail trains were getting cited for not being able to produce their fare cards showing that they had paid much more often than white riders. So the executive board of Sound Transit met this week, executive committee, and they adopted a policy that will take effect on September 1st reinstates fines of up to $124 and imposes legal penalties against riders who repeatedly fail to pay their fares. That new policy could result in court action. And there's nothing in this policy, as near as I can tell, that addresses the racial disparity that that originally prompted the policy change, except that they will not have uniformed, essentially transit police patrolling the trains and light rail trains. Instead, they will they'll have people in plain clothes. I don't know that that makes any difference in terms of the racial disparity, but that is the plan. So all you freeloaders, you better stop freeloading by September 1st.
Yeah, according to the article, under the new policy, riders will get 2 warnings in a 12-month period, followed by a fine of $50. Fines will only rise to $124 after the 5th time fare checkers catch a rider without proof of payment, and anyone under 18 will be exempt from legal penalties, which I guess means they're checking people's IDs too when they're issuing these.
That's a good question. I mean, you know, part of it is that there are several high schools on the Link Light Rail South route, so a lot of high school kids ride it. But those schools are primarily students of color, so that, you know, I don't know.
Well, in Seattle school district opted to, you know, over time has eliminated, which once was a more robust school bus system. They no longer use that, and they pretty much rely on public transportation for half. I mean, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's a significant portion of the transportation solution for students these days.
Yeah, and they're supposed to get, I believe they're supposed to get fare passes, aren't they?
I don't know. I don't have kids.
But, who knows? Anyway, I'm not a kid, so I don't know. So, yeah, that's Sound Transit. Meanwhile, back on law enforcement, we had a national advocacy group selected to serve as the third-party administrator in the newly formed effort to share a $30 million package that was created in the wake of the 2020 protests that hoped to address inequity by creating a system of more direct control of community spending. Now, more direct control of community spending means having a national group administer it. Doesn't seem kind of counterintuitive to me. The group is called the Participatory Budgeting Process.
And project.
You're right. And they would facilitate the process. It's not clear to me whether they make the final budgeting decisions, or whether they have, you know, community input, that makes those decisions. So, that was the only bid that, after the city put out that, bids or requests for bids for that process. There were no local groups that actually bid to run that project, which was interesting. So that's a little bit of follow up on some of the stuff coming out of the 2020 racial justice protests in Seattle.
Yeah, saw that in the Capitol Hill Seattle blog. Another
great
local resource that people should frequent.
Yes.
Okay, and then getting back to what many consider a local treasure. there was an article
You kind of stumbled on that word, Mike. What's the issue?
Well, it just really depends on, you know, whether you're getting their press releases directly or just, you know, seeing the rubble in the street that they cause. The Intercept this week had an article about a little feature Amazon is working on.
Yeah, and this honestly, this sounds a lot like Microsoft software that is used by the Chinese surveillance state. So The Intercept was reporting that Amazon will block and flag employee posts on a planned internal messaging app that contain keywords pertaining to labor unions. It will flag words like slave labor, prison, and plantation, as well as restrooms, since, of course, that's one of the chief complaints of many Amazon warehouse workers is the lack of restroom breaks, to the point where some of them pee in a bottle in order to keep up with their quotas. Yeah, there was a full list in the Intercept article. I would encourage people to go read it. It was from a leaked internal memo. That sounds fairly totalitarian and again, speaks to the expansion of corporate rights in the workplace under the current Supreme Court that, they really, can control, what you say, what you think, during your work hours. And this should be understood as part of their effort to prevent the further spread of unionization among warehouse workers in particular, since that was where unions broke through in Staten Island earlier this month.
Yeah, and just another indicator of, the things that the behemoth known as Amazon continues to do that encourages these people to form unions within their organization.
Exactly. Although, Amazon puts so much time and money and forces employees to spend time listening to anti-union rhetoric, which, of course, is a classic union-busting technique, you wonder just how much they fear having to shell out in order to give their employees decent paying conditions. How much more that would be than what it is now, in other words.
Moving on, I think that takes us now to this week's developments with the pandemic.
Oh, yeah, there is still a pandemic going on. I think I've said this before. New cases are up 100% in King County over the past 2 weeks. They had also doubled in the previous two-week period. So, you're looking at more than doubling since mid-March. This is primarily the subvariant known as BA2 of Omicron. It is still Omicron, but it's a different type that is more transmissible and appears to be just as deadly as Omicron. Omicron was milder than the previous variant Delta that took hold and the original virus. So hospitalizations are down, or at least they haven't risen significantly, but infections are way up and they are breaking through among people who have not had booster shots. So, get your booster if you haven't had it already. We saw a number of additional high profile political figures getting, testing positive for Omicron this week. Those include, Nancy Pelosi, who is nearly 80 years old, Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who I think is similarly aged, Adam Schiff, who's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, who rose to prominence during the impeachment hearings and the various investigations of Donald Trump. It's making the rounds in Washington. Apparently there was a quote A-list dinner unquote in Washington that 53 people have been infected so far as a result of. So social distancing is still a good idea. 6 feet probably is not adequate because that's an instruction that dates back to March of 2020, whereas since then we've gone through three iterations now of variants or subvariants that are more contagious than the original. So you would think you would need even more distance at this point. The CDC has been really quiet on that front, however, as with many other fronts. They have not issued any additional guidance. Even when Delta came up, close to this time last year, let alone the two more recent variants and subvariants. So, still waiting for the science to come back, I guess, on that.
Seems like the science is already out on that, I mean, CDC has just been constantly relaxing and bending over backwards to accommodate the business interests.
And they're not supposed to. They're supposed to be issuing guidelines based strictly on public health considerations. They answer to the Department of HHS, and that in turn answers to President Biden, and that's where the tone is getting set. And the official White House line is continuing to push vaccinations, but it really needs to go farther than that. Go ahead.
We have a mutual friend who will be a name for the show who attended, I think it was last weekend, an event. It might have been middle of last week. Anyway, attended an event at a retreat and was masked. I think everybody was masked. And also these people also had their vaccinations. And like the bulk of them this week, it turns out, all came down with COVID.
Yeah. And bear in mind that even if you test positive for COVID and don't get any symptoms or the symptoms are very mild, it's still about a 30% rate for people developing long COVID. And people don't know what causes that, why some people are vulnerable to it and others aren't. But it can be really debilitating over a course of weeks or months. The risks if you get COVID are still substantial. Go get your booster. That's the best protection at this point. And if you're eligible for it, get a second booster.
Exactly. I was going to say, because I know that second boosters are available now. And
I got mine on Thursday.
All right.
On Wednesday. And, you know, I still kind of feel cruddy. But which is a good sign because you want to feel cruddy because it means it's working.
Second boosters now currently available. And those are available to, like, everyone or just people over 50 or?
People over 50 and immunocompromised and people with serious health conditions.
Okay.
That's what's been authorized so far. I strongly suspect that if you go to your neighborhood pharmacy and just walk in and say, I want a second booster, they'll just give it to you, depending on where you go. You fill out a form, it asks you for your vaccination history. If you happen to have your cards on you from previous vaccinations, that's good. So they can make sure enough time has elapsed because you don't want to do it less than 4 months after your previous booster. I think they just take people's word for it.
Yeah. And is there, any expense involved with that? Because I'm seeing reports from people I know who have been traveling recently in the last week that they are getting hit with some pretty serious fees for the required testing that they have to do before they cross borders and or go through checkpoints.
Yeah, like going into Canada, for example.
Or to the UK or.
Yeah. I don't think so. I think the testing is starting to be phased out. It depends on the state you're in, but the actual vaccination should be free of charge at this point.
Okay.
That may change in the future, but for the time being, they're still free of charge.
But that does bring up again the whole thing. The U.S. Has done a dismal job on testing since day one, and it didn't improve very much, if at all, when the Biden administration came in. And now they're basically completely ratcheting it down. It's like, my God, it's like the single thing that they should definitely be doing is the freaking testing, you know?
Well, and not only that, but because cases tend to be milder, you're getting a lot more people who never get tested who have it. So the case counts are probably a dramatic undercount at this point. And that, of course, gets to another point, which is that people who don't get tested, don't know they have it, keep spreading it. And contact tracing, which is a phrase you have not heard at all since, spring of 2020, this was supposed to be something that health departments could do to determine essentially the epidemiology of individual infections and trying to combat community spread. Well, the community spread's been so bad that people basically just threw up their hands. And you've still got a very high rate of community spread in a lot of places around the country, including King County, but particularly in the Northeast, particularly in the Eastern Seaboard, where it's heavily populated. you know, I saw a county by county map of that recently, and there was an awful lot more red than you would glean from mainstream media reports. We still have a pandemic on our hands, and particularly in King County.
Well, it sounds like globally that it is picking up steam as well.
Well, it is not in some areas, but parts of Europe are still heavily affected by the subvariant. And then the original Omicron variant is wreaking havoc in East Asia, particularly China, particularly the city of Shanghai, which has been under lockdown since late March. That's a metropolis of 26 million under lockdown. There have actually been protests, which, of course, is a big deal in China because they're not allowed to have protests, that people can't get out to get groceries, get medical appointments, you know, get to essential services. You know, you can't keep an entire metropolis that's significantly larger than the New York City metropolitan area under lockdown forever. And that is what is happening in Shanghai right now. And, you know, there have been some other cities that you've probably never heard of in China that have been under lockdown as well. China in overall, you know, recorded its first official death recently from COVID since the original outbreak in Wuhan. Now, most people assume that just means that they have been officially reporting the deaths. And that China has been underreporting COVID all along. But nonetheless, the so-called zero tolerance policy is just not working because the community spread is too widespread in a place like Shanghai, which has had a ton of cases in the last month. Again, a very densely populated metropolitan area. It's once it gets a foothold, it's very hard to stop.
Anything else on highlights of the pandemic this week?
Oh, yeah, you're going to have your annual pilgrimage to Mecca this year. Saudi Arabia had canceled that the last 2 years, but I believe it's called Hajj. I'm not sure how to pronounce it. I'm so ignorant about Islam. But they're going to have checkpoints before they allow pilgrims to enter, make sure they've been vaccinated, et cetera, et cetera. So they are going to try and take precautions. But, you know, that is a very, very crowded annual pilgrimage that, especially since it, I mean, normally it draws over 1 million people a year. And I would expect that since it's been canceled for a couple of years in a row, it would be even more crowded this year. But that is going to happen. So we'll keep an eye on what comes out of that, if anything, because that has the potential, since people come from all over the world, literally for that. You know, what if they get infected and then go back to their home countries? That is the concern. So, you know, sort of like Florida and spring break. It's a super spreader event.
Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
Mentioned Florida, and though I'm not sure it specifically makes the news this week, many issues that are near and dear to Florida, like abortion and its, red state take on the whole thing. It continues to come up in other states here across the U.S. with Idaho and Oklahoma having proposed changes in laws this week.
No, those laws have passed in Idaho and Oklahoma. And the Oklahoma one is particularly draconian. It not only, you know, enables authorities to charge both the mother and the doctor performing an abortion with murder for, you know, killing the unborn child. But it has the same kind of features that the original Texas law that the Supreme Court refused to act on had, enabling private citizens to essentially get bounties for reporting women suspected of having abortions, which, you know, strikes me as a very modern variation on the old witch hunts that, you know, you can start rumors about some woman you don't like in your small town. And, you know, suddenly, you know, there's a, you know, she's getting hauled into court. This is it's deeply misogynistic, of course. And the thing is that I don't think a lot of the Republican legislators who are proposing these laws really care about the consequences. They're just trying to reap the perceived political benefit of appealing to their rabid base. You know, the Republican Party has gotten so far off the rails, and we're seeing variations on these draconian laws around things like school districts, women's reproductive health, the don't say gay law in Florida, et cetera, these red meat, reactionary issues. They're going to go after contraception next. You can guarantee that, the Griswold case. Because of course what Texas unleashed with SB 8 is all anticipating a ruling from the Supreme Court, in a couple of months. It's coming right up, in the June term on, a Mississippi case that would basically overturn Roe v. Wade. That is already functionally happening now in a lot of Republican controlled states. And there's at least, 15 plus other states that are considering similar legislation. So, it's not a good time to be a woman of childbearing years in America right now. Put it that way. And if you happen to get sexual assault, not only may it not be investigated, but none of these laws have exceptions for rape or incest. And it used to be standard among anti-abortion activists that they would make exceptions for that. But, not anymore. So, you will be forced to carry a child to term. And if you don't like it, too bad.
All right. Handmaid's Tale made real.
Pretty much. Welcome to, what is it? Galea? I forget the name of it. Gilead, that was it.
Gilead.
Yeah. It's been a while since I saw it. Very, very discouraging week in legislative news around the country.
Sticking with the theme of discouraging news, there's multiple shootings this week, but one on Sunday, last Sunday in Sacramento.
Yeah, it was actually late Saturday night. 6 people killed, 9 people wounded in a popular nightclub district in downtown Sacramento. And they have arrested a couple of suspects in the case already. Once again, it seems like every Saturday night, and I don't want to jinx it tonight, but every Saturday night there's a mass shooting somewhere. And to say that alcohol or drugs are involved in the majority of these shootings is a pretty safe statement. So not a good situation. And, once again, thoughts and prayers, but, no legislators will actually do something about the epidemic of, guns in America, readily available and, high capacity magazines. You're getting these high body counts specifically because of the magazines, automatic and semi-automatic, weapons, including semi-automatic, long guns, which is, really kind of terrifying. So another Sunday morning in America. Let's hope we don't wake up to it tomorrow.
All right. Well, there was a bit of good news this week where a man who's been in Guantanamo for 20 years finally is getting released.
Yes, and 14 years after the U.S. government dropped all terrorism charges against him, and 6 years after being cleared for release. Now, being cleared for release doesn't mean that you can be released, because the U.S. government still has to make an effort to find another country that is willing to take you. In this case, Sufyan Barbomi, I think I'm saying that correctly, was first detained at Guantanamo almost 20 years ago. He's an Algerian citizen. He's finally going back to Algeria. The Biden administration announced last weekend that he was being returned to that country. He was captured in Pakistan in 2002 in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, of course, and as with many of the Guantanamo prisoners, was handed over to the United States shortly thereafter and then held without charges or trial. He never really did get a day in court, but the U.S. government dropped all the charges against him, as I said, 14 years ago, and it took him that long to be released. He will never get those years back. And the U.S. government, the Biden administration says it's trying to close Guantanamo. I don't know how quickly, given how long it takes for individual prisoners to be released, I don't know how realistic that is, but, good on them for trying. And I don't know if Congress will allow them to also. There have been previous efforts to try and defund Guantanamo in annual budgets that have been overridden by Congress. So Congress certainly has a say in that as well. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes. But that was an individual piece of good news this week, is that Mr. Barbone is back home again and trying to rebuild a life.
Yeah, the U.S. really does not like giving up its military bases.
You noticed, yeah. Guantanamo, of course, is an artifact of, before the Cuban Revolution in 1959. Guantanamo was there before that. They did not give up that little chunk of the island, even though the rest of the island was taken over by a government that it promptly embargoed and tried to overthrow in the Bay of Pigs. Guantanamo is an aberration, and it's specifically the prison for war on terror prisoners was put there because they were afraid to house those prisoners on U.S. soil because they would then be subject to the United States Judicial Code. By having it overseas, and of course they kept some in Afghanistan when they had the bases there as well. Lest you forget Abu Ghraib. This is where the U.S. prefers to do its dirty work, out of sight, out of mind, out of reach of the U.S. judicial system.
Mm-hmm. And a reminder that, of course, the U.S. is not subject to the International Criminal Court. So.
No, this has come up a lot with Ukraine recently because Russia is not either. And, people say, well, Russia, you can't try Vladimir Putin in The Hague because Russia never signed it. Well, you can't try any U.S. president there for the same reason. I don't want to draw a false equivalence between what the U.S. has done overseas and what Russia is doing right now in the Ukraine, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But the U.S. has done plenty of terrible things over the years in a lot of parts of the world that it will never face any accountability for.
All right. Let's move on to this week's developments in Ukraine.
Yeah, it's been a bad week, of course. We talked last week about the discovery of mass graves and civilian shootings in the Kiev suburb of Bukha as Russian troops retreated from the region. They left behind a lot of bodies. And, we found out more this week about the mass graves and the civilian casualties in Bukha. Those images have been confirmed by satellite footage. So, despite Russia's denials and claims that it was Ukrainian forces who did it, which is the standard response to everything, it seems, it's pretty clear they were Russian soldiers that were responsible. Yesterday there was a missile strike in the southeast Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk. These Russian Ukrainian geographies, I'm getting good at reading it, but I still can't pronounce it. Kramatorsk is the city. It's in southeastern Ukraine. people were queued up in front of a train station trying to evacuate the city, and a missile struck that crowd that was queued up outside. At least 52 dead, over 100 wounded, and more people are being evacuated from that city and from the region as Russia appears to be consolidating its forces, trying to exert control over southeastern and southern Ukraine. It does not yet control the city of Mariupol. City is really all that's left between connecting the Crimean Peninsula with Russian forces that control much of eastern Ukraine at this point. And we're continuing to get unconfirmed reports out of Mariupol, because nobody's being able to get in or out, that not only has the city itself been nearly leveled by repeated Russian shelling over the past 5 weeks, but that the death toll there is very, very high. And that's primarily civilians as well. So, we saw a lot of articles in Russian state media over the past week. You know, in other words, the official Russian propaganda that is basically making the case for the extermination of all Ukrainians. And if that sounds extreme, it is. It's called ethnic cleansing. And we're seeing some policies in the part of Ukraine controlled by Russia that would back that up. For instance, the forced kidnapping of kids from their mothers, and they're being not only exported to Russia, but being fast-tracked for adoption to Russian families. Now, if that sounds vaguely familiar, it's because that's what we were doing with kids separated at the U.S.-Mexican border under the Trump administration. So Russia got the idea from somewhere. They got it from us. Nonetheless, we don't know the scale at which this is happening, and it may be fairly widespread. We just don't know yet. But we're starting to get reports from within Russia of this happening. We're seeing a lot more European countries provide Ukraine not only with short-range but intermediate and long-range weapon systems. As European countries decide that, hey, maybe Ukraine can win this, but the question is at what cost will there be very many Ukrainians left by the time Russia is done? Russia has primarily withdrawn now from most of the northern part of Ukraine, at least for the time being. And we also saw evidence this week that in the Chernobyl exclusion zone, which is still highly radioactive, 36 years after the original accident at Chernobyl, that Russian troops had basically traipsed all over that exclusion zone, using bulldozers, digging trenches, and in the process digging up earth that is probably heavily contaminated with radioactivity and exposing themselves. Those troops, of course, were probably doing it under orders. And again, reports this week that morale among Russian fighters is very low at this point. They've been in the field for 6 weeks, primarily cold weather, very poor supply, supply chain. So they're not getting food except for what they can steal or loot. And I talked last week, of course, about the widespread looting that's been going on where Russia has had control. It's just a bad, bad situation. President Zelensky calling it last night not only war crimes, but speaking specifically about the train station attacked in Kramatorsk, that these really do amount to an effort to ethnically cleanse Ukrainians. And, it looks like, for the immediate time being, southern and southeastern Ukraine will be the battleground where people pay the highest price. A lot of shelling overnight in Mariupol, but also in the port city of Odessa, which has not been directly attacked yet by Russian troops. That's the third largest city in Ukraine with, or at least it used to have, about 1 million people. So it's on the Black Sea. It's strategically incredibly important. It's been sacked and occupied by, countless different empires over the millennia. And Russia appears to be the next to have its eyes sighted on it. So, yeah, overall a very, very grim week in Ukraine.
You had cyber
attacks. Oh, yes. There was also an announcement earlier this week, which didn't get a lot of attention, but I want to highlight that you may be wondering why Russia didn't launch its wanted cyber attacks extensively, not only in Ukraine, but the United States and European allies when it first invaded Ukraine. Well, the United States announced this week that they were responsible for stopping that, that they had disabled an entire cyber attack network that Russia had set up to try and attack, key infrastructure in all those different countries, including the U.S., that attack was stopped by the United States, which is interesting that the U.S. has that kind of capability to go into individual computers and disable embedded networks like that. But apparently it does, and apparently it exercised that capacity against Russia at the beginning of the war. Now, why that is not considered a direct attack on Russia by the Biden administration, but a no-fly zone would be, when they would both be basically defensive measures being taken. I don't understand that distinction, but the United States apparently has already been taking aggressive measures, or countermeasures, I should say, against Russia in this invasion. And it really has been a global effort involving not just the United States, but intelligence agencies in other countries as well. So, yeah, we are at war, actually. We just haven't made it formal yet. And we may not. You know, it's not clear, other than shipping weapon systems, what the U.S. and NATO allies are going to be able to do to support Ukraine at this point. And what is the world's obligation to intervene when you can see basically genocide unfolding in real time, in the age of social media, cell phones, videos, etc. Because it is getting out.
Anything else on that?
No, let's move on.
El Salvador appears to be pushing for something called a state of exemption.
Yes. And that basically, keep an eye on El Salvador, even though there's a lot of other international news going on with the pandemic and with the war in Ukraine. They declared a state of exemption a couple weeks ago. That was decreed by President Bukele. The statement basically exempts law enforcement from due process when they arrest people, and it's in response to a string of recent homicides. But of course, the concern is that the Salvadoran government at this point is fairly right wing, and right wing governments in Salvador do not have a good human rights track record. I'm stating that mildly for anybody who remembers the 1980s. The U.S.-backed right-wing governments have a pretty atrocious human rights record, actually. And there's been low-grade civil wars off and on for years and years. And there is still a low-grade civil war going on in the Salvadoran countryside, even though a ceasefire was announced, I think, sometime in the teens. Keep an eye on that. The Salvadoran government at this point, of course, is heavily supported by the United States, as are most of the governments in Central America right now. El Salvador is one of three countries that has been fueling the Central American refugee crisis that has made its way to the United States southern border, along with Guatemala and Honduras. All three of those countries have a number of problems converging at once. They have very high murder rates. that is due to drug cartels, by and large. Although, you know, those drug cartels seem heavily embedded in, military and police forces as well. And then also in the rural areas, you have severe drought due to climate change, that's been going on in the northern part of Central America for several years now. That's making it very, very difficult for people to make a livelihood. So they head for the United States border. Remember the infamous caravans? Scary. That disappeared as soon as the Trump administration decided they were no longer politically useful. You're seeing, pushback now, Congress, Republicans in Congress insisted on retaining Rule 42, which is the public health rule under which, the Border Patrol and ICE were, refusing to allow asylum seekers, which have been primarily from Central American countries, not all, but a lot of them, from entering the U.S. due to the pandemic. So they're massed on the Mexican side of the border, waiting for, you know, some kind of process in the United States to be reinstated, or the pandemic to go away, one or the other. So that refugee crisis is all tied into the human rights crisis in El Salvador. So keep an eye on that, and also the right-wing governments in Guatemala and Honduras, because the United States is not doing good things in that part of the world right now. And there's a history of that that goes back a long, long ways, not just the 80s, but, you know, back to, you know, banana plantations and United Fruit and all the rest of that history for people who've ever studied that part of the world. It's very familiar. So yeah, what goes around comes around.
Yeah, I started following that back in the late 80s, El Salvador and Central America. And back then, the U.S. was supporting and allied with the president, Roberto Dabusan, whose nickname at that time was Blowtorch Bob.
Yep.
For how he dealt with his opposition.
So, yeah, and that came in the wake in the early 80s of what has since been recognized as a genocidal campaign against indigenous populations in Guatemala, which is right next door. So a lot was going on in that region in that era, and the Reagan administration was four square behind the really overtly fascist regimes, as well as the Contras, which was the U.S. supported effort to overthrow the government of Nicaragua.
Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time for this week.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll go back memory lane again next week. Bring you more good news. But, yep, I'll be back.